Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with James Scott from Bibendum, who is the Market Insights Manager. How are you, James?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. What's the difference between Marketing Insights Manager and Market Insights?
Well, I would imagine if Marketing Insights existed, it would be insights around how to market and being a marketer. In terms of market insights, what I do is I look at statistical information and consumer information that helps us get a clearer handle on what consumers want to see rather than what marketeers want to sell people.
So you're more statistician as opposed to smooth, charming guy?
I'm customer-focused statistically. I think that's the best way of putting it.
You seem pretty smooth and charming, so... Okay. What we're going to do today is talk a wee bit about some of the trials that you've been looking at in terms of trying to position wine to people in a different way. A lot of it seems to be building on the work that Tim Hannay had. And about 2 or 3 years ago, Tim came over to a Bibendum trade tasting, and I interviewed him and did a few shows with him, talking about some of his insights, I suppose. Do you want to summarize what you think are the key parts that you've taken from that and you're trialing with various people?
Well, Tim's obviously been working on a tasting using prop for quite some time and putting a variety of different food colourings and using magnifying glasses to count the number of taste buds in any given person's mouth. He's worked extensively with some of the universities in California, and he has translated for wine what's been sort of thought of in scientific circles and worked on in scientific circles since about 1931, when Arthur Fox first blew something up in front of one of his friends at the DuPont chemical factory.
Oh, I didn't know that story. What happened there?
In 1931, Dr. Fox, not related to the DJ, was doing an experiment. Well, so the tale goes. He was doing an experiment on a desk next to a colleague of his, and it all went slightly awry, and he blew something up. And once the dust had cleared, his friend sort of went, "What on earth was that? It tasted disgusting." And Fox went, "I don't know what you mean. I didn't taste anything." So they started doing some research into what it was he was playing with, and it was prop that he was working with at the time. And then they started looking at people's different taste worlds.
Okay.
Now, that work was taken on by Linda Bartoshuk at Yale and later at Florida University. And Tim came upon this once super tasters, tasters and non-tasters have been talked about for several years on the back of Bartoshuk's work. And Tim, inspiringly, saw an opportunity for it to translate it to wine, to help people understand what remains and what has been for a long time a very exclusive product. And one of the things that we've worked very hard to do at Bibendum is to try and open up wine to as many people as possible, because we firmly believe it's a great product with a whole spectrum of different flavours along it. And if there is any person that is interested in drinking a flavoursome alcoholic beverage and hasn't engaged with wine before, then clearly as a wine supplier and as the retailers that we work with, we must be doing something wrong. We're just not getting the message across. And sometimes it's because we use language that's completely impenetrable, and someone just looks at it and goes, "Well, that makes no sense to me. I have no idea what cigar box flavours are, or why I should be remotely interested in putting anything in my mouth that tastes like a cigar box."
Or horse manure, or sweaty saddles.
Indeed, farmyardy notes. Oh, that's delicious, delightful, marvellous. Nobody particularly wants to do that. And also things like meaty and fleshy and stuff like that. And whilst it's always good to describe mouthfeel, it sounds a little bit like an episode of Waking the Dead, which is all a little bit depressing.
Tim's work was a lot to do with bitterness in particular, though, wasn't it? And looking at people's sensitivity to bitterness and tannins in wines.
Absolutely. And what we've done is taken the some of the questions that Tim has worked with for a long period of time and used those to help talk to customers about wine without actually mentioning wine. So we talk about coffee and salt and artificial sweeteners or aspartame. And we get them to take a couple of questions, and then they get a number as a result of that. And that number correlates to a profiled wine range. And as a result, that can give somebody who's previously been completely befuddled by wine an opportunity to enter the category. One of the things we found a real success with in all of the trials and tastings that we've done with it is it's given people who are either new to the category a point of entry, normally anchored around an international varietal. And then once they've tried that international varietal, we can get them to try slightly more esoteric products. So, for example, once they've gone with Pinot Grigio, we can maybe introduce them to Pic Bull de Pinot or something that they would definitely not have picked up previously. Mm. The opportunity there is also for somebody who's potentially stuck in a rut. They might drink New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc till the cows come home, and they just think...
And good on them too. Yeah, you know, well, I'm a Kiwi, so...
That's brilliant. Yeah,
it's using the wrong word. Chardonnay is on you.
I wouldn't suggest that necessarily anybody that drinks New Zealand Sauvignon is stuck in a rut, but what I would say is that some people can put themselves off a product if that's all they're drinking. If there's no variety, it is the spice of life,
yeah.
And we can help them sort of find products that are similarly flavoured. So rather than getting sick of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and stopping buying it, they will try a different product, broaden their repertoire and actually enjoy more wine.
What are the different groups and how do they work?
Well, there are roughly four groups.
Roughly, not exactly.
There's a totally exactly four groups. I don't know where the word roughly came from. But there are four tasting groups. I guess the word roughly was in my mind because with the original super taster, taster, non-taster, there were three groups. Mm-hmm. But through Tim's work, he realized that when applying it to wine, there was a sweet taster that we really needed to add on to the bottom of that. So Tim came up with four groups that were super taster became hypersensitive, taster became sensitive, and non-taster was tolerant. And at the below hypersensitive, he put sweet. Now, one of the things that...
So it was more than hypersensitive.
More than hypersensitive.
Yeah,
hypersensitive, if you will. So, in,
not below, but above hypersensitive.
It depends which way you work it, forgive me. I always think of sweet at the bottom and tolerant at the top. And the idea being is that we each sit in one of these overarching groups, depending on how many taste buds we have, / how sensitive we are to bitterness.
And that, when you were talking about that prop chemical earlier, that was, I've forgotten the name of it, but that's basically a chemical that if you're hypersensitive, then you really notice the flavour of it. And if you don't, if you're a non-taster or intolerant, you don't really notice it.
Completely. Propylthiazide is supposed to be a bitter compound that only people with the people who tolerate it are people with slightly fewer taste buds. That's the idea. But the questions that we use depart slightly from propylthiazide in the sense that they use compounds, talk about compounds that we have in everyday life. So coffee, artificial sweeteners or aspartame and salt. So things that people use regularly. And it's about your sensitivity to those three that we can get a really good picture of your individual sensitivity. And we then put them into one of four groups. If you have slightly fewer taste buds, you are tolerant, or as we call it, you enjoy intense wines. If you have slightly more taste buds, you are smooth with us. If you have even more taste buds, you are what previously was hypersensitive. You enjoy crisp wines, generally dominated by fruity aromatic wines. And then below that, we have sweet, or wines that could be described as luscious. Mm-hmm. So there is luscious, lots and lots of taste buds, very, very sensitive.
And they're using the sugar
sweetness.
To hide the...
Absolutely. Really, really crave sugar. And there's nothing wrong with craving sugar. I'm a massive fan of Moscato myself. It's absolutely brilliant.
Moscato d'Este.
Yeah, fabulous stuff.
I love that stuff. And no one ever wants to drink it. But
wow, it's
in fact,
I
tried one of your bottles, actually, of Moscato d'Este the
stunning.
Other day. And it's good.
Oh, it's absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, I like it. I think that is. Yeah.
It's absolutely marvelous.
Very floral label.
Oh, it's absolutely stunning. Beautiful packaging and a fabulous wine. We have luscious wines, crisp wines, smooth wines, intense wines. So what you do is you take the test, you have your three questions, you answer the three questions, and you have a number which fits into one of those groups. You can then find within those groups wines that you are most likely to enjoy. And what we say is when you answer your questions, is that that is a sweet spot. In some cases, it will work as a high watermark in the sense of you can taste down the spectrum and it will get slightly sweeter. So you're still likely to enjoy wines that go, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 numbers below where you sit. But if you taste up, it's going to get increasingly intense as you go. So do be warned, don't go too far above your particular number.
When you say intense, you mean like hard? The wine will taste harder and less fruitier?
The wine will have invariably a lot more tannin. It will be potentially higher in alcohol and will also have spent potentially much more time on oak. Mm. A combination of those flavours will ratchet up the power rating, if you will, of that particular product.
Yeah. Okay, so you work with Tim. I know he was doing some surveys and some taste tests a couple of years ago. What was the outcome of that work that he was doing?
Well, there were separate pieces of work that we did with Tim. We took the questions on trial and we put them into different environments in bars, on restaurant wine lists. We did some tastings at Ascot Racecourse, direct consumer tastings, where we profiled a range of wines and asked people to take the test, get their score and try some. So we did those and they were very successful and people were found that very, very exciting. We had a number of people there, a broad spectrum of people that you wouldn't necessarily expect. One image will stay with me for the rest of my life, was a rather large gentleman, about 6'5" and probably at least 240 pounds, looked like an NFL linebacker. And he came up wearing a big leather jacket and sporting a fabulous moustache and said, "I'm a pink butterfly, could I have some of that, please?" Because we'd classified everything by butterflies. And he was hugely excited about the product and he was drinking lots of sweet rosé and off-dry vouvrays and things he would never have dreamt of trying before. And he and his friends found that brilliant. And also with Tim, we did some surveys. And that survey, we unabashedly incentivized it with a trip to California for people to go and actually see Tim. And because of who Tim was and because of interviews that he did with people like yourself, we got a decent amount of interest and news in it. It made Radio 4, it made The Guardian and The Times and The Telegraph. And as a result, quite a few people were galvanized to take our online survey, potentially win a holiday, and answer what were, to be honest, some quite boring questions about how they interacted with wine. And that's helped us to develop what we call the taste test. Not only is the taste test a potential merchandising solution that helps people gain access to the category in a retail environment or in a bar or outlet, it's also a data bank, a very, very rich data bank of information for people up and down the country. We have had over 25,000 responses, complete responses to around 50 questions, including what's somebody's first choice country, what other countries are in their repertoire, how much they spend on wine, as well as their flavour profile. And for each of these people who've completed the test, we have a postcode for them. So whilst we keep all of their information completely anonymous and keep it sort of safe here at Bibendum, what we have done is map the flavour profiles of the United Kingdom. And it allows us to, when we go up and down the country, to understand people's regional differences.
And is there regional differences?
There are, very much so. And we know from our work that, you know, France is, for example, front of mind for lots of London consumers and people in the southeast. But in the vast majority of the rest of England, Scotland and Wales, Australia is the number one country. We've also seen New Zealand. This will be something that's of great interest to yourself. New Zealand is hugely popular in southwest London, which is coincidentally where quite a lot of wine journalists live. So they sort of see New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc on a regular basis. And it's very easy when you live in London to make an assumption that everybody around the rest of the country is doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
Wrongly, I completely concede. But as a result, there has been a certain amount of thought that New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is massively popular absolutely everywhere. And there are parts of the country where nobody's really engaged with it, which is sad for them in many ways and an opportunity for New Zealand. That's one of the things that we've been able to find. Because the last thing anybody wants is somebody trying to shoehorn them into a category or to go and have a conversation in Scotland with somebody who's running a perfectly brilliant wine business and catering for their audience, and then to go there with these preconceived ideas of what Londoners want and try and superimpose it on the marketplace. Mm. And so it's been really, really eye-opening. One of the key things that we found, for example, is that New Zealand and Chile bear interesting comparison, because you have people who drink New Zealand very, very loyally, a small percentage of people who pretty much that's all they drink, whether it be Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, you know, Shiraz, Merlot, wherever. They're very loyal to New Zealand, and it's not just Kiwis. But what you do find is that it's not in a lot of people's repertoire up and down the country. Whereas with Chile... produces some fabulous wines. We know that. It's an incredibly diverse country and almost a perfect canvas for a winemaker. But it's not quite permeated the consciousness of the British population as such. It's not front of mind when it comes to thinking of wine. You think of France, Australia, New Zealand, Italy, South Africa, before many of the consumers think of Chile. That said, it's in a broader scope of people's repertoires than New Zealand.
Yeah, well, New Zealand's quite expensive, though, so you could see why southwest London is popular, because there's quite a bit of money in southwest London, whereas you get to less well-off areas, and perhaps the price point is just not the right price point for people.
Oh, completely. And one of the things we find with chili is that it's hugely reliable. It's recognised for people that shop in both the off-trade and the on-trade as creating indicative expressions of the varietal. So if you suddenly walk into a bar environment and the four people that you're with have abandoned you, one of them's gone to the loo, one's on their phone and one's gone to Bagsy a table, and someone just hollers, get a bottle of wine, and you don't know what to do, plenty of people look up, see chili and go, oh, thank goodness there's some chili and wine there, because I know I'll be safe with that decision. You're completely right to point out that one of the things you talk about with the pricing of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and versus the pricing of chili, that does affect how people interact with the category. But equally, you've displayed straight away your intuition as to how things might work around the country. And a lot of what we're trying to do is put some of the science behind the intuition, because we live in commercially and economically quite uncertain times. And there are plenty of people that are a little bit reticent about making new decisions. And I mean that from a business perspective, as well as a consumer standing in front of a wall of wine, all of which is increasingly expensive and increasingly obscure. And one of the things that we try and do is actually go, well, you know, you did think that, you know, people who had a certain amount of money would buy New Zealand Sauvignon. They might buy Malbec from Argentina. And you do think in certain areas where discretionary spend on wine is lower, that they might be interested in countries that provide more approachable entry-level wines. Historically, countries like Chile and South Africa.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is natural. That's great insight. That's somebody understanding their market, working in their market and appreciating that. But so many people are not prepared to make business decisions based on just their insight. And what we can do with our flavour map, with all of mapping of the answers to all of our questions, is help region by region, even postcode by postcode, people understand what people, what their consumers would like to drink and see on shelves in their area.
All right then, James, I think we're going to wrap it up there.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Cheers, bud.